You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful Davis day. I'm not going to say bright and sunny because my sky is overcast. How's yours, Don?
It is overcast, mostly cloudy, and that's exactly what the National Weather Service says right now. Again, thank you to the longtime listener long ago who said at the start of each show, you need to say the date. Lois and I are preparing this show on October 22nd, 2025 for broadcast October 23rd, 2025. As I look out the window, it's partly cloudy. It's 60 degrees here and it's going up to a high today of 70 degrees. Yesterday's high was 82 degrees, which was very pleasant. And people kept remarking on what wonderful fall weather we're having this week. It was 82, 80 the day before, 82 the day before that, 79 the day before that, 75 the day before that, with night temperatures in the very low 50s. A few days ago, we did get into the mid 40s. So there's been some effects out in the vegetable garden. We're finding that tomatoes, for example, are spoiling as quickly as they're ripening. So
that means take them in before they spoil.
Yeah, with rain possible, when we were getting a chance of showers a few days ago, we picked the bigger ones, brought them in, dried them off, set them on the counter so they would ripen without the spoilage and have more even temperatures. But it's lovely weather right now. It's great gardening weather. I can tell you people are really gardening enthusiastically with vegetables. What? Vegetables? Yes, we're planting lots and lots of vegetables right now. Thursday's temperature is going to be 72 degrees with decreasing clouds. Thursday night will be clear, mostly clear, 50 degrees. Friday, partly sunny, 71 degrees. For the last week, we've been watching an atmospheric river brewing, heading towards the western coast of the United States. I looked at one weather forecast out of Victoria, British Columbia. It's right on track for them, Pacific Northwest, and all the way down into Oregon. And I see that the National Weather Service has given up on this thing hitting us. Friday night, we have a slight chance of showers, and it's only going to be 55 degrees. Saturday, a chance of showers, 50% chance of showers, 65 degrees will be the high. Saturday night, 51 with a chance of showers. Sunday, 64 with a chance of showers. Looking at the various private weather services, such as Weather Underground, they're not even showing a tenth of an inch out of this atmospheric river hitting us. We're going to be on the very fringes of it, seeing mostly clouds and some slightly scattered showers. Who knows? Here and there, there might be more. But if you look at Ventusky or some of the other satellite imagery north of us, Pacific Northwest, Northwestern California, Eureka, for example, they're expecting an inch or two, the places that usually get more rain than we do, but not much for the Sacramento Valley. But great weather for transplanting things. If you were thinking of moving a shrub, dividing a perennial, planting some wildflower seeds, scattering seeds to make your lawn denser, scattering seeds to replace your lawn with a meadow, putting in more vegetables, planting a tree, this is all a great time to do it. This is the weather we wait for. This is when we're talking to you in the middle of July and it's going to be 110. Maybe you want to do that in late October when the temperatures are in the 60s and 70s and there's some moisture in the atmosphere. Go ahead.
I know what the air temperature is because we talk about that every week. How's the soil temperature? Is the soil still warm enough for those things that like to be planted in warm soil?
Yeah, there's a lag effect on the soil temperature, and the soil temperature is still plenty warm. That's why your pepper plants, for example, still look good out there, growing and yielding and ripening just fine. The soil temperature is something you can look up at the Simis weather stations, and the soil temperature has dropped in the last week from 65 degrees to 63 degrees. So not exactly a plunge, but it is, you know, in that trajectory. Still warm enough for the summer vegetables in some cases to keep going. And when you plant out the cool season vegetables, you'll find they take very quickly. So you usually ask me at some point in this, hey, what are you planting right now, Don? Well, I planted 36 cabbage plants 2 days ago. Residents of my farm really like cabbage and its relatives. So I pulled out the cucumbers.
How do you grow cabbages when you have that flock of turkeys invading all the time?
We will find out. That was my thought, too. I got them all planted out, and I walked out the next morning thinking, okay, it's make or break. I've got them fenced off from significant parts of the vegetable garden, but they still have access to this area, and they're still intact. They're all fine. But the other residents of the property and I are consulting on the need for some cross-fencing. But they took without even missing a beat. This is the thing. These little seedlings, you buy them in these six-packs, and they look so fragile, and you're sure they're going to collapse. And they took without, as I say, I watered them in, really. Important. I've now watered them every other day since planting. I planted actually 3 days ago, watered yesterday morning because they're ready for some water, and they're already putting on new growth. So this is great weather for putting out the brassicas and things like that. With cabbage, just a slight digression here, I chose the faster forms. There's one called Fast Vantage that we sell at our nursery because it heads up more quickly. A little later in the season now, I prefer to plant that one. But just as an experiment, since I like to do this for you folks, I also planted a couple of the old-fashioned 90-day cabbages just to see if planting in late October is any problem. I can tell you from previous experience, they'll probably be fine. But if you're looking for things to plant right now, this weather couldn't be better for the brassicas and all those winter vegetables, as well as all the other things we talked about earlier. Events, you got something to talk about there?
Oh, I want to tell listeners that they can dress up in their Halloween costumes if they want to and join us at our Halloween style Suds and Sounds meetup. So the edition here is Wednesday, October 29th from 4 to 6 p.m. And it's at Armadillo Music, which is on F Street between 2nd and 3rd Street. That's in downtown Davis. And feel free to wear your costume. Some people will. There's also going to be live music. I don't know. Do you know Nancy Northrup?
No,
she's
there,
a
yeah.
local singer
yeah.
and songwriter.
Yep.
And she's going to be there. She's going to be singing for us.
Cool. All right. So you can join some of the catered crew down there at Armadillo. And what's the address again?
It's between 2nd and 3rd Street on F.
There you go. Yep.
You know Patricia, don't you?
Yes, Patricia Carpenter. Carpenter. Yep.
Yeah. Well, she sometimes does these rambles, and she has got a fall ramble. It's going to be November 2nd. That's a Sunday. And it's County Road 97, just off Russell Boulevard.
Yeah.
And so if you want to go out there and take a self-guided tour, there's a map that you can find. It's sponsored by the California Native Plant Society.
Yes.
And
CNPS.org, and you can find the information there about all their events, and it is listed there. Patricia has a reference collection, is what we refer to it as, of California native plants. She started almost 20 years ago, I think, planting California natives on a slope where she is out there west of Davis, and has just added to it and added to it. She also has a lovely and amazing garden. It's not just native plants, but her California native plant garden is an excellent reference for folks thinking about doing some landscaping, or right now looking out at their properties and thinking, maybe I'll have a native shrub in that corner instead of some common shrub. All right, we got a bunch of quick questions, and I think we'll just go through these. I sent them over to Lois at the last minute. These are just things that have come my way that are reasonably topical to the time of year, I think. Let's start with new grape varieties. You got that one in front of you?
Can you get the Moondrops grape?
Nope.
That's,
no,
a good, that's a quick answer.
That's a very quick answer. There's a whole bunch of grapes that have been produced by a company called IFG, which I'm trying to remember what it stands for, that has bred all these amazing new grape varieties that you're seeing in the grocery store. The breeder, I believe was from UC Davis years ago, started breeding in higher sugar content, higher Brix content that he found in a particular grape, bred in the higher sugar content, and then started coming out with a bunch of really interesting grapes. Some of them have unique shapes, like the one called Funny Fingers, which is elongated. You're probably seeing that one in the store. One of them was unusually sweet, and it was called Cotton Candy. There we go, big round
Or
one. That
candy
was,
snaps.
there's a bunch. There's 30 of them now. The key to know about these, yes, you're seeing them in the store at their appropriate season, and this is a company that's focusing on quality. Sugar content, not trying to aim for the high volume market, but for the high quality market. They're
And
all
cute
trade.
names. I mean, their names are just
Yeah,
amazing.
Sweet Surrender, Sweet Globe,
They
Funny
have one
Fingers.
called Quip. It makes me want to go out and buy it.
Yes, indeed. Very
Quip.
good. Well done. The
Yeah.
candy drops. And people ask about these periodically. They have trademarked the name. That's the first thing. The plants are not just patented. I assume that they're patented. They are licensed. So the growers that do them, this is true with some of the apples you're seeing in this store. This is true of certain other fruit. They're aiming at a particular part of the fruit buying market, the higher end. When you're in a grocery store, you'll see these on the end cap displays, not just lined out with the other things. Those they've paid more for that placement in the grocery store. They're at a higher price or at a premium price because they are premium quality. The growers do not own the plants typically. They're licensed to grow the plants. They cannot propagate them, and I cannot get the propagation stock. They are carefully controlling who has access to these plants. This has worked for some of the apple growers, and there are some apples you can get and grow and some that you can't. And what they found is that people will pay a premium price for a very high quality fruit that's predictable, predictably high quality, and unique in some way. And so, this particular one that someone asked about, the Funny Fingers one, which is elongated and it does look very funny, and they kind of look like fingers, hence the name. Extremely sweet, 2 to 3 degrees Brix higher content than most grapes that you would typically buy. So, very sweet. Good texture. He was looking for a nice, firm, crisp texture and really high quality. And they want to control the product that goes to the marketplace. So they control who can grow them and they control the budwood. So the short answer is nope.
Nobody can get you those for your
No,
lawn.
you, if you're a grower, you can partner with them.
But
And
if you're a
you,
home gardener,
not a chance.
go to the
No.
grocery store.
Yeah, you'll buy them in the grocery store.
So ask at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Okay. Next. Now, I want to go back into my sequence because otherwise I'll
Yep.
get lost.
Okay.
Okay. So we did about IFG. And then the next thing up I had was the calendar for folks who are interested in where this is and you want to go look at it online, redwoodbarn.com/calendar with a capital C. Anyway, so there's some pretty flowers up there. And then it says eggplant pick now. I think it's over, isn't it?
I just picked one, but yeah, our season is winding down early. We've had the most rapid drop in temperatures, average temperatures that I've seen in living here all these years. Generally speaking, middle of October, we're still out there picking these things. Now the night temperatures are getting in the 40s, so my guess is the quality will be somewhat impaired. But yes, if it's out there, I would pick it. There's one important one here.
What's that?
Houseplants. Houseplant, October 11th. If you go to our calendar, it has little text things that tell you, vegetables, do this now.
I see.
Houseplants,
Move them
move
back
them back inside
inside.
by Halloween. Yes.
Now,
Okay.
why would you have your house plants outside if they're
Be
house plants?
because my house plants, when they're indoors in the summer, one, the light is very low, and two, I completely neglect them. So it's
So
much.
you have indoor outdoor plants.
Absolutely, yes. And they're much better off for that. They go outdoors. I can water them easily. I can wash them off when I water them. I have a porch that is ideal for this, and many of you may have this. Mine faces east, so and it's under an overhang. So if they get any sun at all, it's only in the morning for, less than an hour, and that's okay with most house plants, not much more than that. And then they're in the shade of a high tree and they're in place near a hose so I can wash them off and all that kind of stuff. But now, as we get into late October into early November and the night temperatures are dropping into the mid 40s, these are tropical plants,
Yeah.
many of them. Anything in the philodendron family, the aroids as we call them, are truly tropical plants. Where they come from, it would rarely get below 60 degrees. You get into the 50s, okay, they go into a slight metabolic change and that's not great. You go into the 40s, they'll start to yellow some older leaves and some root damage may start to occur and they're more vulnerable to rot. So once we get into the 40s at night, is one way to look at it. Typically here, that's mid to late October, by Halloween for sure, it's time to bring them indoors to protect them from colder temperatures. Not frost, that's later. We're probably 4 to 5 weeks away from frost, but just colder night temperatures. Cold soil is not great for tropical plants. Very important. to check them for two things. Any bugs of any kind on the leaves, that could be aphids, could be spider mites, it could be things like that. So wash them off. White flies could be on there in some cases. Mostly they're not a big problem on indoor plants, but they can be. But yeah, look on the undersides of the leaves, look and inspect carefully. Scale might have been brought on there by ants. That's the other thing to check for. Ants. I can tell you as a nursery professional, ants love nursery soil. And so there's a possibility that ants have moved into your pots while they're sitting out on the porch. And so you might want to, you know, give a good soaking and see if any ants come out of the soil. If
that's... So when I used to have plants that were outside and then came in for the winter, I had a little process that they went through.
Right.
The pot, if it was small enough, got put into, I have this rolling cart, and filled up with water so that the cart was filled with water and it was over the top of the pot.
Right.
And plunged. I sat there for at least an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
So that got totally wet the way through. If there were any ants or anything in there, they're gone.
Well, they are. It takes longer than that to kill them if a whole nest is moved.
Right, but they'll come out.
And the first question, I mentioned this process to people, going ahead and just drowning them in a bucket of water. And it, you know, it can submerge the whole plant if you want to. The question is, how long is it okay to leave the plant in there? Several hours is actually fine if it comes to that, as long as you do take it out eventually and then drain it out. And it may take, if the ant nest has moved into a large container and the queen has moved in there, it will take probably at least a couple hours before she will finally emerge, even if it's underwater. There are air bubbles trapped down there where she is. And when she emerges, you have taken care of the nest. She will come out. She'll try to leave. You can kill her if you want, but more to the point, she will go away. The other ants will follow her. Your problem is solved. It can take a couple hours in a bigger pot for that to happen. But the key thing is just look for them, because ants coming in with your plants can be rather annoying. So check for bugs before you bring them inside. The other key thing is your outdoor conditions, no matter, even if they're shaded, are brighter than your indoor conditions almost invariably. So bringing them indoors, you're dropping the light status of that plant substantially, anywhere from 25 to 75% or more. No matter how bright you think it is indoors, remember that a lot of the lights you're using are not a light that plants can make use of. So they need the window, or they need light augmented with grow lights. Generally speaking, if you bring them indoors, put them in the sunniest window you have. East or south exposure is typically what you're after for that, for at least the first few days. In other words, transition them to an indoor light environment rather than saying front porch and into the corner of your living room. If it's your ficus, you'll drop half your leaves if you do that. So be aware that you're dropping the light status, and give them at least initially, even if it's inconvenient, set them on top of the television if you have to, as much light as they possibly can get for at least a few days, a week or so. Then you can move them to the lower light place they're eventually going to spend the winter. But also,
and if they're a ficus, they'll drop their leaves again.
They will anyway. Yeah. It's just a matter of how many.
Ficus just do not want to move at all.
Yeah, they adapt to new locations is the positive way to look at it. That's and they will. They'll drop 25, 50% of their leaves as long as new growth is coming out. All right. Well, they've adapted to that new light status. I'll tell you one trick I have found with this bringing plants inside. I always have a lot of begonias by the end of the summer, and begonias range in how cold hardy they are. I've learned the hard way which ones are hardy and which ones are not. Some of them can stay out on the front porch just fine. Others would be killed by that. When I bring in the cane begonias, if any of you are collectors, you probably know some of these, and I put them in the sunniest window I have, which faces south and now is getting direct sun through the window, they go into bloom, and they start blooming, and they stay in bloom mostly through the winter. So if you're looking for a blooming indoor plant and you have a sunny window and you have any of these aren't your fibrous begonias, bedding begonia. Well, they might work. I don't know. I've never tried it. I'm talking about the ornamental ones that we grow more for the leaves, the spots on the leaves and the big tropical looking leaves. They all flower.
What about angel wing?
Yeah, angel wing is a good example. And that's actually a classic one. Or the Richmondensis is another one that's pretty common in the trade. There's a bunch of these. We love to stock begonias because everyone on my staff likes them. And we have customers who come in looking for, what are the new begonias you have now? When I bring them indoors and put them in a sunny window, many of them come into bloom and continue to bloom right on through the winter. Mm-hmm. And there aren't very many plants I can say, Yes, this will flower for you indoors. We get that question all the time. I'm looking for
A
something.
beautiful one. Yeah.
Yeah, there's peace lilies and there's African violets and things like that, but those each have their special issues. You know, they're not that easy to keep in bloom. Begonias seem to do it on their own, and I discovered this a few years ago. Some nurseries are selling them in 4-inch pots or quart pots. Buy one, stick it in a 6-inch pot, you know, move it up to the next size just to make it easier to keep it watered. I use cactus and succulent mix for my begonias. Sounds weird, but they are succulents, kind of.
They drain well. Yeah.
They need good drainage, and they actually hold a lot of water, and I find they go into bloom. So if you're looking for something that gives a little color indoors, bring your begonias indoors or go buy one at this time of year. But anyway, it's pretty close to time to bring those tropical plants in and check them for bugs. I'm sitting here watching three tree squirrels tear apart a planter in my backyard. Excuse me for a moment. I'll be right back.
So while he's gone, I'm going to tell you about the pictures on the October calendar. We've got chrysanthemum, penstemon, rudbeckia. Ooh, that's a pretty rudbeckia. Lavendula, which is lavender. Phlomis, pansy. Fuchsia Gartenmeister, which is that lovely, looks like a bright red-orange firecracker. It's wonderful. Hummingbirds love it. Dahlia, Plumbago capensis. Now, that one has just come out for me. And so I now have these beautiful, very pale blue flowers all over out front. Phagelius, another hummingbird-attracting plant. Asclepias, that's for the butterflies, but it's also beautiful to just look at. Salvia greggii, autumn sage. Lantana, I've got to tell you about that in just a minute. Autumn aster, there it is too. And Brugmansia. Now in my yard, the autumn aster comes out. I know when it's fall, when I see the first of those lovely lavender purple flowers. They're little daisy-like flowers. They're so cute. But other than that, when they're not blooming, they're kind of rangy looking. They're not the prettiest plant.
Okay, I'm back from harassing wildlife. What they were doing, just for the record, is they had climbed into a planter that I had just filled with snapdragons, which you can plant now. And they were disrupting them wildly. I've never seen the squirrels quite this frantic because of the rapid temperature drop that we've been having. And I gather that there'll be a lot of walnuts and pecans in that planter after they're done. So thank you for going through the list of plants that are blooming. And it was interesting about the seven, I think you just mentioned. Three of them are subtropicals, the plumbago, the brugmansia, and the lantana. Others are hardy, but deciduous. The asclepias is deciduous, and the asters are deciduous. They're blooming now, and then you cut them back. And the salvia greggii, boy, is that a wonderful, wonderful plant for this time of year. Salvia greggii, salvia microphylla, the hybrids between them. All these southwestern sages are in full and glorious bloom right now, and there's an amazing range of colors on those hybrids. So this is a great time to go select the autumn sages, as they've called the salvia greggii for years. These new hybrids, many, many hybrids between them that have occurred naturally and also intentionally. Fantastic group of plants from most parts of California. They're very drought tolerant, but also can take garden watering. And they bloom, although they bloom, scattered bloom kind of all the time. Heaviest bloom starts in September, and then October, November, they're in absolutely full bloom. And these are very, very attractive to hummingbirds.
Don, I think I may have made a mistake. I got a lantana from you, radiation, and I just planted it in the place where I thought it would get the most sun, which is out on the back patio, away from the house, just right out there in the world. And you just told me they're subtropicals. Do I need to bring it in closer to the house?
No.
Is it going to survive out there?
It will be damaged, but it's a hardy. We need a term for these plants. Nurseries sell tons of these types of things. They're hardy subtropicals. So I've had staff tell people they're deciduous because they lose their leaves from frost, but they're not deciduous in the sense that a maple tree is deciduous, where it embarks on a process of an abscission layer and the leaves drop in a methodical manner. They're only deciduous in the sense that their leaves get frozen off. And sometimes the tops are killed back to some degree. So they don't, most of these hardy subtropical plants, this includes abutilon, it includes the brugmansias, it includes bougainvilleas. There's a whole lot of plants in this category, much more characteristically grown in Southern California and the coastal zones, but hardy enough to grow here. And they're on a spectrum. Some of them are absolutely fine. Others are, well, if it gets through the first winter, you'll be okay. Like, hibiscus, for example, sometimes will get through the winter. They are damaged by cold, but they reliably recover from it. Lantana radiation. Radiation was one of the first of the hybrid lantanas that came on the market, 1950s or 60s, back when they put names on plants that suggested atomic power. One of the most popular hybrid lantanas are the Chimera hybrids on the market. In our area, it gets to about 5 feet tall and 6 to 8 feet across. If you let it, it'll do that. Very vigorous plant. Prune it as hard as you want. It blooms terminally like a butterfly bush does. So you can cut it back constantly and it keeps blooming. It's a very big, robust, tough, and reasonably cold hardy lantana. It will freeze back. If we get below 30, it'll probably defoliate. The stems will probably not be harmed unless we get to 29 or 28 degrees. They'll die back somewhat if we get that cold. But even in 1990, we got to 16 degrees on our farm. My lantana, radiation, Dallas Red, that whole group from the 50s and 60s, killed to the ground. I was sure they were dead and they resprouted. So this is a plant that we can tell you is subtropical, but hardy enough to grow here in USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zones 8, 9, 14 to 24.
Well, if this plant was 6 feet wide and 4 feet tall, like the one outside the radio station used to be, I wouldn't worry about it because it would be the tips that, got. This poor little thing is, I mean, it's brand new. I
Yeah, that's
just pulled
fine.
it out and it's like 18 inches tall.
This is important. A subtropical plant, the first winter that you plant it, you may get more damage than usual because it's young and most of the growth is still semi-hardwood or green. That's what's likeliest to get injured, but the stem is hardy. It'll come through. And here's the thing, we've had winters where they're not even damaged. In fact, if you remember the one at the radio station, which finally got taken out this year because that's where the bike parking is going at that building. But for 25, 30 plus years, this one plant, or maybe it was two, filled the entire bed, climbed up onto the windows. It was quite impressive. That one actually looked good well into the winter,
They
partly
did.
because
I
that
loved it.
building faces south. It's under an overhang and it's
And
got
it's in a little
concrete.
cutout so
Yeah, a
that it's
little.
got building on three sides, and on the fourth side was a sidewalk
Yeah, this,
radiating whatever sun we got.
so we would occasionally get cold enough to damage just the part sticking out from under the overhang. The rest of it even would try and bloom right through the winter. So those of you with lantana plants in the interior, be aware that they do frost back. They'll bloom right up until freezing weather. The ground cover forms, the purple one and the white one that hug the ground, are even more cold hardy. They typically even try and bloom right on through the winter here. This new bright yellow one called New Gold, which is a phenomenal garden plant, same thing, appears to be hardier just based on the different species parentage. And so that one will try and bloom through the winter. It can look a little rough if we get very cold. But they're on this spectrum of subtropical plants that are hardy enough to grow in the interior here in the valley and also in interior Southern California. There's a lot of plants in that category. If we get really cold, if here we're going to have an unusual regional freeze and you're worried about your lemon tree and your this, that, or the other, that would be one plant to consider protecting. Personally, I wouldn't bother because I know they came back from even very, very, very cold weather a number of years ago.
So I'm thinking for emergency protection, if I got a large tomato cage and then it covered the top and the outsides with a frost blanket, leaving the bottom open with the prong sticking out, then whenever I got that warning, and because I listened to the Davis Garden Show, I might get
We'll
that
tell you.
warning. And then I can just walk out and set that thing over it, push it down with the stakes into the ground, and it'll be totally covered.
Yeah, tomato cages can do serve double purpose that way, and they're a really handy way to cover it. And yes, just the frost blanket that nurseries sell, which is also called floating row cover, it's used for a bunch of different purposes. It's a white gauze-like material, and it does allow enough light to penetrate to keep the plants alive during the period when it's on there. Best to pull it off now and then to get actual natural sunlight directly on the plant and better air circulation. Because if you leave it completely covered from, let's say, late November through January, I guarantee mold is going to grow on the leaves in there because of the lack of circulation. But it's a really simple way to provide 2 to 4 degrees of plant protection. And that's all you need for a young citrus, young bougainvillea, young hibiscus, if you're going to try and grow the tropical hibiscus outside, and things like a lantana that you've just put in that you don't want to look rough. But I can tell you probably don't need to worry about the plant surviving all of that. For those of you that don't want a 5 or 6 foot by 8 foot lantana, There are a whole lot of new dwarf ones on the market. The Pot of Gold series, the Lucky this, that, and the other. I mean, the names are kind of cute. And they're selling them in the bedding plant display at your local garden center because bedding plant growers have found these do great in 4-inch and quart pots. They bloom, they're tight little growers, they're strong colors. They literally just sell themselves off the shelf. So if you only have room for a 2 to 3 foot lantana, they're out there. They're available. And it's the same thing. Once we get into freezing weather, the top will be injured. The leaves may freeze off. The stems might die back somewhat. But when they first came on the market, I planted these. I sold them to people where we said, this is a bit of a test. We don't know for sure. We monitored them. They've come through the winters just fine. So they're just about as hardy as the kind you have. If you got room for big old lantana radiation, cool. It's a wonderful plant.
Yeah. Okay. I have in front of me a very interesting chart. And this is something off of Don's site. It's an actual chart, like a graph, and it shows the deciduous fruit and when they ripen. So the ripening dates of deciduous fruit were in October. The only thing I see for this week is Braeburn apples are still coming on.
Yeah, late
And
apples. Braeburn is a good
late.
example of a late apple for this region that does very well. People often ask me, they move here from apple country, Wisconsin, Michigan, Cornell, that's Ithaca,
Washington.
Washington, yeah, Oregon, Mount Hood region, and so on. There are not nearly as many apple varieties that do well in this area. They grow fine, but in many cases, the fruit quality is impaired by our late season dry, hot conditions. The fruit is more mealy. I've discussed this with people who moved here from, say, New York, which is New York State is apparently nirvana for apples. They're crisp, they're juicy, they're sweet, they're wonderful, and they will grow the same variety out here in California, and it doesn't have that same oomph. Well, I can tell you
Though it
physically.
might have worms.
Well, you'll see them. The codling moth is really obvious, but the physiological condition is that a drought stressed or a tree subjected to high temperatures and just hot, lower humidity, the cell walls, the fruit cell walls are thicker. And so when you bite into it, the juice sacs don't burst in your mouth. So yes, it is mealy. The texture is not all that pleasant, but there are varieties that do very well here. Gravenstein is a classic heirloom apple for Northern California. The Russians brought it in to the Sebastopol region. Sebastopol should be a clue right there that the Russians brought it in. And it does very well in the Sonoma County, Napa County, and does fine in the valley as well. It does need a pollinizer, interestingly, and it's one of the few apples where that's really important. It is self-sterile. And it's mealy. It's the applesauce apple. So mealy is fine. People don't mind. That's what it's actually intended for. It's also quite delicious off the tree, especially a little bit underripe. Braeburn, Fuji, Anders,
But they're
Granny.
not all ripening now, are they?
No, the
It's
latest one.
Braeburn
Well,
is the late one.
yeah, it is the late one. And Fuji are pretty much done, although I did find a few more on the ground under my tree that were still firm. Apples get worms. This is not really apple country. They're a high water tree. They are some susceptible to fire blight, but I do want to mention a couple of varieties for those of you listening in lower chill areas. I have one that I got by accident called Anna, Anna. And I looked it up, finally figured out what it was after the thing had been ripening on my property for years, and I could never figure out what it was. Anna, it only needs 200 chilling hours. For those of you in Southern California, this one will do fine for you. Mine blooms with the almonds. All right, folks. So that means it's blooming. I have pictures of it every year. It starts blooming in late February and blooms through mid-March. Because of that, it never gets fire blight. Because the blooms are at least 3 to 4 weeks ahead of when fire blight is attacking all the other members of the apple family. It's obviously self-fruitful because there's no other apple tree ripening or blooming nearby at the time it's in bloom. Certainly not being pollinized by almonds. That's the only other thing that's blooming. So, and it sets very large crops. This year, we had probably 150 to 200 of these somewhat elongated apples. They're slightly mealy if you let them go long on the tree, but if you pick them earlier, they're pretty juicy. Good quality, good enough quality, in my opinion, as a backyard tree. I don't know why this one never caught on particularly, but if you're in nurseries in Southern California, particularly looking for an apple that's a low chill variety, Anna, Anna, has done very well for me. And yeah, it gets codling moth, but they all do. All apples get worms. It is not going to be 100% of the fruit on your tree. We had a very heavy fruit set on our apples this year. I have 12 apple trees. We had a very heavy fruit set on them. And the folks who share this property with me were out there going, "Wow, there's a lot of these that don't have worms in them." Yeah, there's a lot that do, but there's a lot that don't. And it's really easy to tell. I mean, when you look at an apple, if there's a worm in it, there's a point of entry. You'll see the frass coming out.
Brown
I do
spot,
suggest cutting into them before biting in, just to be on the safe side. But in general, you can tell quite readily if there's a coddling moth worm in the apple. And generally, it's just one in the apple. It's pretty easy to cut it out. So apples do grow here. Anna is one to consider if you're in a low chill area. Fuji does very well in this area. Most of my customers who plant Fuji get very good crops, and they're happy with the quality. And the thing about Fuji that people like, and this is true worldwide, probably the most popular apple in the world at this point, is that it's great underripe for those who like a crisp, tart apple and a firmer texture. And it's fine very late in the ripening season, even as it's getting softer. It gets a bit mealier, but the juice is still there and the quality is good. So you can pick it over or even pick it up off the ground over about a 3 week period. So Fuji is a good one. Braeburn is a late ripening one, and there are others. And I even have heirloom apples on my property that have, after 10 years in the ground, finally started fruiting. 15 years in the ground, they fruit consistently. No idea what they are because they weren't labeled. That's why I have them. And they're giving more and more fruit each year. I would have trouble selling those varieties since it took them a good 10 years to start fruiting, but they have. So don't give up on an apple tree is the lesson from this. It's growing, it looks healthy, you're not having a big problem with fire blight. Get someone who knows what they're doing to correctly prune it, train it, that you don't hard prune apples because they're fruiting on spurs. They can be quite beautiful trees if you allow them to grow more naturally. And just be aware that some of the fruit will have worms in it, most of it, if you don't do anything about it. There are things you can do about coddling moth that'll help you have more worm-free apples. And be patient. They take a while to really start coming into production. But yes, Braeburn are ripening all the way into November.
Okay, next up we have so you wanted to talk about the UCIPM weed photo
Well,
gallery?
I know this lady who sent me a picture of a weed.
Oh, I had taken something out of a big planter, not quite as big as a half barrel, but close, and it's a big ceramic planter, and we removed that, and then we just left it with dirt in it. And then this thing started growing, and it looks really pretty. It's small, but boy, it's had little rosette on it, and then it's got some green leaves above it and stuff. And so that's where the lantana was going. So I got it dug out and put it in an old pot, and I'm trying to figure out what the heck it is. So I sent Don an email here to the garden show and said, "What about IDing this volunteer plant?" And his answer was, "On the show, I'll tell you how I did it."
Okay, so you go to ipm.ucanr.edu. So you can just type in ucanr.edu. That's all you really need. There is a phenomenal weed gallery there. It's called Weed Photo Gallery. You need to know whether it's a grass or not a grass. That's the only thing you need to know. To get started, there are broadleaf weeds and there are grass weeds and sedges and things that are like them. So
This
you
one's a
look at,
broadleaf
yeah,
weed.
clearly not a grass or a sedge. And as you go there, you'll find a list, which is useful if you already know what the weeds are and you just want more information about the particular plant, a tutorial on how to identify it, which will keep you occupied for hours. But the simplest is to click on identification and up comes,
Oh,
sharing the screen with Lois here, plant
I've got it.
forms,
I've got it up. Yeah.
mature leaf characteristics, a bunch of things that are pretty easy for novices to go, "Oh yeah, mine's a spreading plant." All right, so click on spreading plants, and there you go. You can click on spreading plants and look at it. Look at all these pictures,
Wow,
and look
I
down
couldn't
there.
tell anything on this. I mean,
But zoom in closer, and you will go down to a picture that looks surprisingly like the one you sent me. And there is your weed right there, Persian Speedwell Veronica persica, also called Bird's Eye Speedwell. On each one, there are four pictures: the plant infesting, what the seed looks like, what the flower looks like, and what the mature plants look like. And obviously, to identify a weed, we really do need the flower. And this is a challenge for somebody. Yes, there's a lot of weeds I can identify just from the leaves. Some really common ones are quite easy. What Lois sent was actually one of my favorite weeds. I usually don't bother to pull it out if it comes up on part of my property because it makes a ground cover and it's lush looking and it's got a pretty little blue flower. We plant Veronica plants in the nursery trade that are much like this. The only issue is it reseeds quite a bit. So be aware that if you allow this to go, you'll have a whole carpet of Persian speedwell or Veronica, persica, over time as the plant spreads out and chokes out other things. But you have a method here for looking at different options. And then as you click on them individually, you can look closer at the flowers. So this resource is amazing. It's ucanr.edu weed gallery. And there's pictures. That's the key. Botanical keys are something we learn about when we take horticulture and botany. We learn how to do a binary key and you go down the process. And a lot of you are going back to the glossary all the time. Anyone who's taken courses in botany or horticulture knows how to key out a plant from that kind of a binary key. This is a gallery that has pictures, and that's what we think the public is generally going to need. So we can narrow it down quite a bit with this, and then you may see a couple others that look very similar. So zoom in on the flowers, and that's why the flower is so important. Based on the foliage, it looks like Veronica persica, which is a non-native speedwell. It's all over the state of California, Persian speedwell. But for those of you trying to figure out what a weed is, ucanr.edu, just in a little search box, type weed gallery, and that'll get you to what you want to do in terms of looking at pictures. And then if that doesn't help, well, then maybe, taking in a plant and a flower to an expert. But we're going to do the same thing. We're just going to peruse through this resource, because for years this has been online. I have found it the most useful resource in terms of weed identification in California.
This is amazing. So I see all this about habitat and seedlings and mature plants and all this stuff. Is there any reason to ask where a particular weed grows, or because it's a weed, it'll grow anywhere?
It won't necessarily grow anywhere, but they do have preferred habitat, and that's useful. Yes, it is useful to know. The main thing is most weeds will fill vacant spaces. Nature, as we like to say, abhors a vacuum and fills it with weeds. Bare soil is an invitation to weeds, and this is a very timely topic. We had 1.5 inches of rain a week ago. So I walk around my farm now, it is a solid carpet of grass seedlings coming up. They're already 2 inches tall in just a week. They're mostly oats. Some are foxtails here and there. Some are annual ryegrass. And in one area, it's mostly native grasses. But they're already within, a week after a rainstorm, a couple inches tall. This is the time. We said this last week. Now it's a week later. This is the time for you to get weed control going on the winter growing annual weeds, including the ones that turn into foxtails next spring. We just pulled out our 20 foot by 100 foot silage tarp. What, you don't have one of those? And the property residents dragged it down to an area where we're going to be planting in just 3 or 4 weeks. And they laid it all out over this carpet of weeds, and they weighted it down with a bunch of stuff that we have. And it's going to smother out those weeds over the next roughly 3 weeks. We'll probably kill out most of what's just come up if we leave it on there. I use tarps for this purpose all the time. And I really want to emphasize this, because people keep coming in wanting to cardboard layer and do this much of this, and I've read this technique, and I said, just buy a tarp. Just buy a tarp, cover the plants with the tarp, spend a little extra to get a tarp with grommets so that you can take those tent stakes that you still have out in your garage and to anchor it down securely, because we get a lot of wind through here. Spread that over any weeds now that the soil is moist and the soil is still warm. This is ideal. And I can tell you, pull it back every week and look at what's happening. Of course, with lack of photosynthesis, the leaves start to die down. Of course, that functions systemically, almost like an herbicide to kill the root systems of the plant. Within 3 to 4 weeks, you'll have significant level of weed control just by covering young weed seedlings with a tarp securely installed. And you can buy a tarp at any hardware store. This is not something you have. This is not like using a pesticide, an herbicide. It's not like special mulch and cardboard layers and arborist.
And you only buy it once.
Yeah, and you can reuse it. This silage tarp is something we bought a couple of years ago, and we're finding it incredibly useful. Well, 20 by 100 feet is something you'd use on a farm, but I would urge you to spend a little more on a heavy-duty tarp, because they do tear. Even better, as I say, the grommets, the holes along the margin, so you can put stakes in and hold it in place with tent stakes, work great. Irrigation stakes work okay. Secure it down, because we do get a lot of wind through here, and leave it on there, and just pull it back every so often to check. Two things will be happening. The weeds will be dying down immediately. Lack of light, they'll just start to die down instantly. And cool little wildlife organisms will move under there too. So when you do pull it back, be prepared for field mice and frogs and whatnot to go scattering as you pull it away. But it is an amazing, simple way to kill weeds once they've germinated. Once they've come up, as they have now after that first rainstorm, a tarp is one of the simplest things you can do. And now is the time to do it.
All right. So we've got lots of questions that walk in. A lot of people are getting damage from caterpillars at the moment on flowering plants like verbena, mint, stuff like that. And one of the questions that came in says, how did they get there? I'm on the second floor. This person is envisioning a caterpillar or a worm or something crawling up the side of the building to get... Yeah. No,
they forgot
the parents fly.
Right. They forgot the metamorphosis part, that it was a moth or a butterfly that flew in and ovipositive the caterpillar that's on there. And then usually we get, why didn't see them? Moths are mostly out at night, so it's quite possible you never saw it. We are getting a lot of funny little damage right now. And I've had this on my own plants. Verbena in particular, but also mint, members of the mint family. Someone planted salvia and it happened on there. Look carefully for little green inchworms or little green caterpillars. This one seems to be pretty specific to the mint family, and it does a whole lot of damage all at once, and then it's done. It seems to have one generation, and they want to know what to do about it. I said, well, by the time you've noticed this damage, it's pretty much done. I don't think you really need to worry about it all that much for two reasons. One, it's probably just one generation, and it's very specific to mint family and verbena family, which are related. The damage isn't really hurting the plant. It's just unattractive to have holes in the leaves, obviously. Yeah, you could cut them back if you want to. I suppose that would be one simple solution. Look for them, but they are exactly the color of what they're on. So I acknowledge that they can be very hard to spot. Temperatures below 50 will slow them down so much that the damage will stop. Caterpillars are cold-blooded. They can't, you know, they need to be in the sun to stay warm and active, and they need it to be warm. We start getting colder at night, all that damage stops. Same thing with aphids, that they, as it gets colder, their activity slows considerably and the reproduction slows considerably. So this is a problem that solves itself, and it typically is, like so many pest problems, only about a 3 to 4 week pest issue. You know, this is one thing to remember, is that most pest and disease problems have a distinct cycle and a distinct season. And most of them don't last more than 2 to 6 weeks, depending on what they are. One question is how much damage they can do in that short time period. Caterpillars do eat a lot. They're very hungry little animals. There's a whole book on that subject. I'm sure you've read it to kids if you have them. A Very Hungry Caterpillar. Plot's a little thin, but the character development is great. They do make a lot of holes in the leaves, cutting off what is damaged. If you can't find the caterpillars, well, that may be one way to get rid of them. That was our suggestion to her, older person. Harder to spot those caterpillars. Yeah, go ahead and give it a haircut. Throw all that away, you know, send it away into your compost or whatever, because there may still be some eggs on there to hatch. You've probably solved the problem. They're usually looking for a spray when they come in with these problems. They want, you know, like the old days, I have a problem, please sell me a pesticide. Well, for caterpillars, there is an organic and very safe pesticide, BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, the first organic pest spray that I remember coming into the industry way back in the 60s. And it works very well, and it is very specific for caterpillars. They have to feed on it for it to work. And it works best on the youngest stage. So right when they hatch, when they first start feeding, you get better results than when you've noticed this much later in the process. So while you could spray with the BT, and it doesn't harm other things except other caterpillars, it probably isn't necessary once you've noticed this much damage. They're probably just about done. So again, the cutting back is probably all you need to do. And again, as with so many pests in October, this is going to solve itself. Even the caterpillars on your brassicas, even the cabbage worm that you get on your brassicas that does so much damage to cauliflower and broccoli and things like that, every now and then I'll just let it go and see what happens. And last year I did that with one planter of cauliflower. Yeah, they practically defoliated them. And then by early November, nights were getting cold enough. The plants were still growing because they do grow when it's cold, but the caterpillars stop. They outgrew it and they produce just fine. So with no treatment at all, those cauliflower plants grew right on through the caterpillar damage and went ahead and produced. I don't think most of you would have tolerated the degree of damage that I did in order to do this little experiment, but they did outgrow it. And they ran their course and they were all done because it got too cold for the caterpillars, which is not too cold for the brassicas. So most of these problems do kind of solve themselves. Once you know more about the life cycle of a particular pest, I have found most people at that point go, oh, okay, don't need to worry about it. Yes. Isn't it one of our main themes here at Davis Garden Show? You don't need to worry about it.
Wait it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Monitor. The integrated pest management term is identify the pest, monitor the damage, and then decide whether there is a point at which you'll need to treat. And the need to treat is where a farmer would differ from, say, a home gardener. Farmer would look at it and go, this is going to affect my yield. It's going to affect my income. The plants are not going to perform as well. I won't make as much money. So they'll have a treatment threshold. And if you go into agricultural entomology, you set those thresholds, X number of caterpillars counted in the following methodology, and you decide to go ahead and treat. Home gardeners, most of the damage you see is cosmetic. And if it doesn't affect, you know, let's say cauliflower, if you still get a nice big head of cauliflower out of the plant, even with the leaves looking tattered, don't worry too much about it. Maybe those white crowned sparrows will eat the caterpillars. Do they? Do they eat caterpillars, Lois?
No, and jays eat caterpillars, yeah. But the white crowned sparrows eat seeds and you know.
Plants. They eat plants. I don't.
Okay, they eat plants. They eat tender little plants.
They sure do. Yeah. And they're back.
Yep.
All right. We had a question from, let's see, Gaina. This was about wildflower. It is a very good time right now with rain already happened and rain coming. That's ideal to scatter seeds of our Central Valley wildflowers. And anywhere else you're listening in the state, it's probably appropriate. Did you find the question?
I have yes. Okay, and this is something that was sent on and forwarded to us from Gaina. I bought some golden lupin, Lupinus microcarpus, and yellow ray goldfield at the UC Davis Arboretum plant sale. Students were selling them at a table. And last year, when I direct seeded local wildflower seeds at the Washoe Corner, hardly any seeds came up, but the weeds took over completely. What do you suggest I do?
Yeah, this is a great topic because this is the time to do it. The wildflower seed mixes are a little perplexing because some wildflower seeds need stratification. Some wildflower seeds need scarification. And some don't need any of that. And they're all mixed together in a packet for you to just fling out into open soil areas. I would guess that the percentage of germination when one does that is 5%. I mean, it's very, very, very low. I've had many people complain about buying wildflower seed, scattering it and getting no results. In the case of the poppies, usually what's happening is that there's stuff there. You're throwing the seed out and there's weeds or grasses present from the summer. And the seed,
wood chips.
Bark, wood chips. And the seed filters down into them. So there's no direct light on the seed. Some seeds need light to germinate. Some seeds need to be not in light to germinate. Anytime a package of seeds arrives at my nursery, which happens 2 to 3 times a week, because we have several people on the staff who are kind of fanatical about ordering weird seeds, the first thing we do is look up whether it has any special germination requirements. Some of them, like lupins, for example, aren't going to come up unless you either soak them or take a file and lightly scarify the seed coat. They'll just lie there and wait for a fire. One of the first things that comes up after a fire, not a convenient thing for you to arrange in your own property, typically. Others will just come up when the weather and the soil moisture conditions are good. So if you did buy golden lupin, and that's our native lupin, Lupinus densiflorus aureus, it is the official flower of the city of Davis, you should at least soak that seed overnight before planting it. Even better would be to take just a file. This is a little tricky, but once you get the hang of it, it's not that hard. They're big seeds. And just buff the side a little bit. Just buff the seed coat to break it up a little bit. And then plant them and you'll get much better results. Go ahead and cover those. They will come up best if they're lightly covered with soil or compost or something like that. California poppies, on the other hand, it's just a matter of timing. Right now, in sunny location, open soil, not covered with anything, they should come up very quickly. The other issue, though, that Dana mentions, weeds take over very quickly. Yes, the grasses that are non-native here, the grasses that are invasive here, oats in particular, barley, annual ryegrass, will come up and grow faster than any wildflower seeds. So they will shade them out, as will mustard, which is very common in fields around here. So if you do direct seed wildflowers, it's helpful to know what the seedlings look like. California poppies are pretty recognizable, as are lupins. Some of the others you might not recognize as well. But any grasses that come up, you need to pull. And that's tedious. I mean, I've got to say, this is the most challenging part of getting wildflowers established in an open area, is that there are plants that will happily adapt to your having created a seed bed and will fill it in and crowd out the things that you intentionally planted. So there will be some hand weeding needed, or else you're basically going to end up with a whole lot of oats and barley and mustard. And somewhere down in there, there might be some California poppies trying to grow, but not very likely because they'll get shaded out, crowded out by the weeds. So it is important to know that wherever you're direct seeding wildflower seed, weeds are going to have to be managed somehow. I'm always concerned that people think that they're going to buy wildflower seed and make a beautiful blooming area just by scattering the seed. No, it's actually way more work than that, just as it's work to get native grasses established because of the competition from these non-native plants, the oats in particular and the mustard that are going to come up at the same time as the things you've planted.
So Don, you know, I have Japanese maples in my yard. This year, for some reason, all of a sudden, so many of the Japanese maple seeds fell to the ground and took root. And so I have 2 dozen, 3 dozen little tiny baby Japanese maples.
Yeah.
I know that a Japanese maple has a taproot and is hard to move.
Kind of, not necessarily. But yeah, you can probably dig them up and move them. First of all, the taproot idea is not consistent. People always think that trees have taproots. Oaks and pines, for example, you plant an oak and the root goes straight down. So if you're growing them for the nursery trade, you have to learn to pinch that root as you move them to the container that you're going to grow them in. But you can dig up Japanese maple seedlings or any maple seedlings when they're dormant in November, or even better, December, January. You can actually just saturate the soil, have a hose running at a trickle until it's soupy, start tugging, that'll probably pull right up as a bare root tree at that point. And you can take that, it's dormant, it's bare root, move it to wherever you want, put it right back in the ground or in a pot, and you have yourself a nice tree. Great for bonsai, by the way, if you know anyone that likes to do that, it's a great way to get started. Some of them might have a taproot, more likely they will have branched, but you'll get most of the root system if you work it, if the soil is soupy, you can probably pull it right out. If you don't want to wait that long, you can go out right now. October, November would be fine. By the way, those seeds undoubtedly went through a full winter, because maples do require stratification for germination. Stratification is a cold treatment. I just took in some seeds of a maple that I'm growing that I want to grow for sale. Amur maple, Acer ganala. I think it's a great choice for this area. None of my growers do it, so I'm going to do my own. Gosh darn it. And I took the seed in because it's mature and ready to fall from the tree. And the person at my nursery who does most of this germination took it and promptly put it into a medium and put it in the refrigerator, where it will stay for probably 6 to 10 weeks, depending on what we look up and what it says in some reference somewhere. 6 weeks minimum, typically. Then we'll plant it like a normal seed in our little greenhouse, in unheated greenhouse, and they'll come up and we'll go through the process of transplanting them. Stratification is just a cold treatment. Oaks, maples, many deciduous hardwood species from more northern latitudes need stratification or they won't germinate well. So yours probably fell a year ago, lay on the ground through last winter, through this summer when they wouldn't typically germinate, but with irrigation they might. And that's when they came up, was at some point in the warm season when they were getting enough water for the seeds to germinate. Very commonly, deciduous hardwood species will just come up on their own underneath their parents. But in most cases, they've had to go through a naturally occurring stratification. What we're doing with stratification is mimicking what would have happened in the woodland. Falls down from the tree, lies on the ground, goes through the winter, germinates the next spring. You don't have to think too hard into evolutionary biology to see what the advantage of that would be. If it came up in October, it would die. It comes up in March or April or May or whatever the spring is where you're listening, then it is going to get into the summer and it won't have that problem. So delayed germination is a really simple adaptive strategy in evolution.
Well, I think that's the end of the show. And usually I'm doing a garden quote. You are what you eat. And ask any caterpillar, and they'll tell you that's true.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.